Boker Tov, Erev Tov, hello and welcome to the first installment in our series on Haggadah Shel Pesach. Hopefully we'll have 5 or 6 shiurim between now and Pesach, trying to go about twice a week, generally on Mondays and Thursday evenings. And we will do this thematically as opposed to textually, meaning that in the first shiur, and I'll give the basic outline of the whole series, in the first shiur we're going to look at an overview of the Seder, some of the issues of order and the different components that make up the order. In the second shiur, which will be early next week, will be on the text of the Arba Banim, but essentially the mitzvah of Haggadah and how we infer it from the Torah and how we end up with these Arba Banim. Subsequent to that, the shiur will focus on the opening paragraph of the section known as Magid, which is Halach Ma'anya. Subsequent to that, we will have a shiur on one of the passages later on in the Haggadah. And then in the final shiur, we'll see how many we can squeeze in. In the final shiur, we will go back to the overview and several of the questions that were raised in tonight's shiur. Hopefully, we will then be able to answer using the material that we have covered over the course of these few weeks. Parenthetically, I might add, for those of you who live in the New York area, I am going to be speaking this coming Sunday morning, March 18th, at Lincoln Square Synagogue at 10 o'clock as part of an OU-sponsored Yom Iyun. And there I'll be speaking on a topic that may not be included in these podcasts. And so interested parties should check out the OU website, OU.org, to find it's the Harry Baron Memorial Yom Iyun. In any case, let's get started in our study of Haggadah Shel Pesach. One other prefatory note, I make every effort to make sure that these shiurim are approximately 30 minutes in length, and to whatever extent possible, can be followed independent of a text, so those of you who are commuting or are working out and want to listen will be able to follow without needs of endangering yourself or endangering the treadmill by having to hold a text up. Seder, Leil HaSeder. There is a little question that the most significant evening in the year for an observant and traditional Jew is Leil HaSeder. And the phrase, the word that we use, Leil HaSeder, is ancient. It goes back approximately 1,000 years. And really, the word Seder, which, as we all know, means order, is part of a larger phrase. The way the Rambam terms it in the beginning of Perek Chet of Hilchot Chametz U'Matzah is Seder Asiyat HaMitzvot B'Leil Chamisha Asar Kachu, the order of fulfilling the mitzvot on the night of the 15th, that is of Nisan, is as follows. And thus, the notion of Seder comes in. And I'd like to spend a few minutes talking about the significance of Seder. We have a whole range of mitzvot that we have to do this evening. And simply put, they break into two general categories. There are mitzvot that we are going to fulfill on this evening. This evening, throughout this series, will be a reference to the 15th of Nisan. There are mitzvot that we are going to fulfill on this evening that are unique to the evening. Mitzvot we do not fulfill at any other time. Eating matzah, eating maror, eating the Korban Pesach, reclining, arba kosot, singing halal, etc. And more than etc., that's fairly exhaustive, although there are many others. And then there are, of course, a whole host of other practices and customs that we fulfill also, which are unique to the evening. And then there is, of course, a whole range of mitzvot that we fulfill, either on every Shabbat and Yom Tov, or every time we have a meal, mitzvot like Kiddush, and mitzvot from the second category, like Berchat HaMazon, and Brachot we make before food, Berchat HaMitzvot. And so therefore, when we look at the items that we're going to fulfill this evening, there are items which are unique to the evening and not unique to the evening, and every one of them has representatives that are classified as deoraita, commanded by the Torah, and there are those that are derabbanan, commanded by the Bible, and we will look at them. By the way, I will link to the site an outline that I made several years ago of the Seder, which lists all the mitzvot and identifies both their category as far as unique or not unique, and also their status as far as being deoraita and derabbanan. But a word about Seder. Whenever you have a list of items, take a look at a grocery list. You have to buy bananas and tomatoes and ice cream and fruit and cereal and milk and eggs. You take a look at the list and you ask a reasonable person, is it significant to you if you buy the milk before the eggs or the ice cream before the bananas? Well, it may be for a small logistic reason more helpful to buy the ice cream at the end so it spends less time out of the freezer. But generally, a reasonable person would say, it doesn't matter what order I go in. I'll go in whatever order is convenient in the store so I don't have to walk back and forth too much, and I'll accumulate the items and I'll get home. Let's say that a person has a list of errands to do, to go to the dry cleaner, to go to the grocery store, pick up the kids from school. Clearly, it doesn't matter what order they're done in, as long as they're all done, each one of them, in a timely fashion. You don't want to pick up the kids at school 3 hours before or 3 hours after they're let out. But it doesn't matter if you got to the dry cleaners first or the dry cleaners afterwards, because, and this is the hard and fast rule, whenever you see a list of items to be done, and the order is not significant, that tells you that the goal of the list is the items on the list itself. Meaning that if you have a list to go to the dry cleaners and pick up the kids from school and stop at the bakery and call the gardener and pay the bills, and it doesn't matter what order you do them in, that means the goal is to pay the bills and to call the gardener, etc. If, however, you have a list of items and the order is absolutely significant, not just because each particular item has its own significant time, like picking up the kids at school at this time, or going to the bakery when the cake is already ready, etc., but rather the interplay between the items is significant, then that tells you that the goal of the list is something greater than all of the items combined. It is something which is not even found on the list. And I'll give you a couple of examples. Let's say, for example, that a person who is absolutely unschooled in this wants to have a surprise party for his friend. Has no idea how to do it. So he goes to another friend and says, how am I going to do a surprise party? He says, okay, I'll give you a list of things to do. You want to hire a band. You want to have everybody come over to the house. You want to have a cake. You want to have emails and phone calls coming from Israel, etc. And then you want to have the guy show up at the house when all of that stuff is ready. So the person makes a list without that last line, when all that stuff is ready. He makes a list. And so then he goes out and he brings the fellow over to his house, the birthday boy, over to his house. And then he leaves. And then he buys a cake. And then the cake is gone. Then friends come over. He does everything in some willy-nilly order. He hasn't accomplished anything. Because, of course, the purpose here is not to have cake. The purpose is not to have his friend come to the house. The purpose is not the phone calls. The purpose is a good feeling, which is derived from doing all of those preparatory steps in a particular order that culminates in surprise and a very enjoyable evening, hopefully. In a much more sanctified and hopefully not rarefied air, we look at the daily practice of an observant Jewish man. Gets up in the morning and he has several obligations to fulfill. Of tefillin, tzitzit, of kriyat shema, of tefillah. We'll just talk about those four. And theoretically, a person could say, all right, I'm going to get up and say tefillah. Gets up and says Shmon Esrei. And then he puts on tzitzit, takes off the tzitzit. And then he puts on tefillin, takes off the tefillin. And then he says Shema. He's done all his obligations, but is that really what the morning experience is all about? Clearly the morning experience is built, is geared towards something far greater than just, and I say just very guardedly, just the mitzvah of tefillin, just the mitzvah of tzitzit, etc. It's geared towards something far grander. So instead, a person gets up in the morning and they wash their hands and they prepare themselves and then he puts on a talus. And then he puts on tefillin. And then says Psukei Dezimra, builds up to a crescendo until finally he declares out loud Shema Yisrael, and he's got his tefillin on and he's got his talus on. And then with all of that behind him, he stands up and takes three steps forward, if you will, and stands in front of Kisei Yaakov and stands in front of HaKadosh Baruch Hu and pours out his heart. If done properly, it is an amazing experience that a person is able to latch onto every day. But it only happens because he does things in a particular order. The goal of all of those items is Avodat Hashem. The goal of those items is not the tefillin and the tzitzis and the kriyat shema and the tefillah. The goal of those items is to worship God. And the worship of God is something which is experiential. However, in order to create that experience, there's a series of mitzvot, and the way that the chachamim, that the sages, ordered those mitzvot and created a sequence for them allows us to have the environment in which we can properly worship Hashem. That brings us back to Leil HaSeder. Indeed, a person has a series of mitzvot to accomplish on this night, and we'll take four of them. There's the mitzvah of eating matzah, there's the mitzvah of Haggadah, there's the mitzvah of the Arba Kosot, and there's the mitzvah of Hallel. Right, we'll start with those four. Two that are Doraita, eating matzah, and Haggadah, telling you the story to your children, and two which are Derabbanan, the Arba Kosot, the four cups of wine, and singing Hallel, singing songs of praise to God. A person could easily sit down at the meal, and after Kiddush, have three more cups of wine. There's then four cups. And then take out the matzah and quickly eat the matzah. And then sit down and tell his kids a story. And then sing some songs of praise. And he's done all of his mitzvot. But as we notice, the order in which we do things that evening is far more significant, far more intricate, and far more nuanced than what I just recorded. Because after all, we start by saying Kiddush, but we don't get to the second cup till much later. In the meantime, we've poured the second cup, we've raised it at one point, but we haven't drunk it yet. And we keep it in front of us, but we don't raise it except for one point in the middle of telling the story. We start telling the story, we do a little bit of eating, we do a little bit of certain kind of actions, go back to telling the story. The food is always on the table, we don't get to eating it until after we tell the story. And only when all of that is done do we sing the songs with another cup sandwiched between the third and fourth cup, really. So we have a sequence which is geared towards something which is greater, and therefore, if asked, what is the purpose of the evening? People will generally say one of two things. And that is, of course, if it's somewhere beyond someone who's going to say, the purpose of the evening is to get together with family and to have a nice dinner. Clearly, neither of those is the purpose of the evening. They are just wonderful, wonderful benefits of the evening. So one answer people will generally give is the goal of the evening is to tell the story to the children. And the other is the goal of the evening, this is certainly a far more nuanced thing, is to re-experience the Exodus from Egypt. Both of those are true, and yet neither of those is sufficient, and neither of those tells the entire story. Because if they were true, then you would have a situation where you could do it in any order, and that would be fine. The fact that you have to do it in a particular order tells you that the goal of the evening is something far greater, although the second answer, which is commonly given, to recreate the events, touches far closer to the ultimate goal of the evening, which is something which is actually found in the Haggadah itself. It is stated quite clearly, but is generally overlooked. We're not going to get to it tonight. We're going to start talking about how the pieces play together. Now, it's important to note that the evening is geared towards a particular audience. Truth to tell, it's geared towards two different audiences, but in a sense, one audience. And that audience, as anybody would answer, is children. Now, by the way, again, I'm not going to answer the question tonight of what the ultimate goal of the evening is. That we're going to get to in the final shiur. We'll climax. We'll build up and get to that. In the meantime, we'll do the work to understanding the Seder more properly so that we can understand the answer and it will fit within a general framework that will build up. We have a target audience this evening, and the audience is children. However, when I say children, we could be referring to a person's own biological children, in which he is directly obligated to tell them a story. It can also refer to people who are children in the sense of their lack of knowledge, people who are new to the Seder, people who have not experienced and not familiar with the story of the Exodus. It can be children in the sense of students. Take a look at the Rambam at the beginning of Hilchot Talmud Torah. Mishnatum Vanecha, Eilu HaTalmidim. So the word children can be read in different ways. And indeed, if a person's own children are not present at the Seder, the halacha is quite clear that other members of the family, and if not, colleagues, and ultimately if not, he himself, plays the role of a child asking questions of the father. So we have a target audience of children, but truth to tell, we have two different target audiences. One which is really a target audience, which is children, to whom we are obligated to pass the story and transmit the information of the Exodus, and there is a whole other target audience, or shall we say, a collegium, and that is of peers. Of peers among whom we discuss the events, not only of the Exodus itself, but really the events of all of Jewish history, which is encapsulated in the evening, as we will discover over this course of Shiurim. The Torah commands us in 6 different places to remember or discuss the events of the Exodus. The Torah commands us famously in 4 different places to tell our children. And that is always an answer to a question, even if in one case the question is unasked, in which specific information has to be presented to the children. And there are all sorts of rules, which we'll deal with next Monday night, Yom Tzeis Hashem, in the second shiur, about how to respond to the child based on the way the child asks the question, based on the child's intellectual development, and based on the child's attitude, and based on the child's maturity. There is a specific body of information to pass on, and of course, year by year, a greater segment of that body can be shared with the child as the child becomes more able to receive. There are 2 other places in the Torah, in Shmot Yod Gimel Pasuk Gimel, Exodus 13:3, and in Dvarim Tet Zayin Pasuk Gimel, in Deuteronomy 16, verse 3, in which the Torah obligates us to remember the day of the Exodus, and it is in the context of celebrating the Exodus. So it's not just to remember it on a daily basis, but remember it in a special way on the night of the anniversary of the event. And that is not a mitzvah of Haggadah, of passing on information from the knower to the learner, from the parent to the student, from the parent to the child, from the teacher to the student. Rather, that is a mitzvah of discussion, of sharing with peers. And that is a very different kind of mitzvah. And if we look very carefully into some of the paragraphs at the beginning of the Haggadah, we'll see that both mitzvot, or both segments of the mitzvah, are presented, and are presented with some of their parameters, time parameters, and tactile parameters, and show-and-tell parameters, if you will. So, and that's something that we will get to at Mirat Hashem also in the next shiur, or the one after that. As such, over the course of the evening, we have a multifaceted approach that has to be taken in order to engage people, both who are our target child audience and also our peers and our colleagues, to involve them all in the discussion. So now we start the evening. We're going to go through the Seder from the beginning. How do we begin the evening? Well, we begin the evening as we begin any other festive evening. We say Kiddush. We have a cup of wine, we say Kiddush. But immediately there's something different. Because unlike any other Kiddush that we make during the year, whether it's Shabbat or any other Chag, any other holiday, including the end of Pesach, where one person takes a cup of wine, makes Kiddush, and either sits or stands and drinks the wine of the Kiddush, and everybody else does get a little bit, doesn't get a little bit, has their own cup with a little bit of wine or grape juice in it, here, everyone is seated around the table, everyone has a full cup of wine, and everybody is going to drink that full cup of wine at Kiddush. The second thing that's different is, of course, that unlike any other evening, on this evening, we're all going to recline when we drink that wine. But otherwise, the Kiddush is a Kiddush. After Kiddush, what's the next step we take? And this is where the famous signs of the Seder, Simanei HaSeder, are somewhat misleading. Because you ask the average person who is somewhat knowledgeable and traditional, what's the thing we do after Kiddush? Say, oh, we wash our hands. And if they know the Simanei, they say, Kadesh Ur Chatz, Karpas Yachatz. And if you ask them, when do you start telling the story? Say, ooh, that's way down the line. That's the 5th step. Have Kadesh Ur Chatz, Karpas Yachatz, and then Magid. And if you look at the list of the Simanim, it seems almost as if Magid is as significant as Yachatz. Well, nothing could be further from the truth. But the reality is that we begin telling the story as soon as we finish Kiddush. One would argue, and Rabbi Soloveitchik certainly was of the opinion, that even the Kiddush itself is part of Haggadah in a sense. But formally, as far as the pedagogic process of teaching, that begins immediately after Kiddush. And let's see why. Remember that we have a target audience of children. It is potentially a long, interesting, stimulating, exciting evening. However, as we all know with children, we have to think, as far as the youngest children, about involving them early in the evening, because afterwards their attention will dwindle, they'll get tired, they may not even make it to later on in the Seder. So we have to grab them early. We have to make sure that those young children, the ones who are just starting to come into awareness, are going to be engaged and involved. And this takes us to a general topic we'll deal with in the next shiur, but it has to be touched upon right now. The format for Haggadah as presented in the Torah is a format not of telling, but rather of question and answer. Meaning, the child asks a question because he sees the parent eating matzah. He sees the parent bringing the firstborn animal at the end of the summer to the Kohen. He sees whatever he sees, as in Dvarim, and says, "What are you doing?" And the answer we give him, "Oh, let me tell you a story. I'll tell you about Yetziat Mitzrayim." And you tell this child, of course, according to his own knowledge. In other words, the ideal format for teaching is by answering questions. And the reason for that is quite clear. It is because the child will be invested and engaged if he is the one who initiates, or she is the one who initiates, by asking a question. So what do you do? How do you get children to ask questions? And the Rambam says this quite clearly in Hilchot Chametz Umatzah, in Perek Zayin. You have to act differently and somewhat strange around the table in order to provoke the questions. And you will notice that all of the strange things, both listed by the Rambam and listed by others and all of the customs, all revolve around one common item, and that is food. All of the strange behavior we have is around food, whether it's carrying matzah on our back around the table, or whether it is hiding the afikoman, or grabbing matzah from each other, or handing out candies and nuts, as the Rambam mentions. All of this is around food, and that's for a simple reason. Food is the one universal. Everybody's interested in food. Whether they're bright, not as bright, whether they're alert, not so alert, inquisitive, not so inquisitive, everybody gets hungry, and everybody's interested in food. And therefore, it's going to draw their attention. So what do we do immediately after Kiddush? Well, we do something that's actually quite familiar to us. Right after Kiddush, we wash our hands. And then the child would come to the table and expect, we made Kiddush, we're washing our hands, all right, we leaned, all right, everybody had a full cup of wine, but otherwise it's pretty normal. And he would expect now to have some bread brought out to the table, just like any other festive meal. And Shabbat, Kiddush, and then bread. We washed our hands first. Wash our hands, come to the table, and suddenly there's a tiny little vegetable. And we did take the vegetable, we dip it in something, make bread pre-adama. Kid's mystified. Why are we doing this? Here we have to talk for a couple of minutes about a very important principle about the methodology of custom, of understanding customs. And it's not just customs, it's even with particular dinim, with particular laws. And that is that we have to distinguish between the original reason why a particular custom or a particular halakha was enacted and between the symbolism that subsequently is attached to it. Symbolism which is holy and which is pure and which is meaningful and which is inspirational, but is not, at the end of the discussion, is not the original reason it was enacted. And karpas is a great example of that. The reason that we take a vegetable and dip it into some liquid, and that's the halakha, take a vegetable, dip it into some liquid, and then make prayer adama and eat it, is simply to get the children curious. There are those who have argued, and I'm not willing to discount their argument totally, that the reason for eating this vegetable is because the Seder was modeled after a Roman fancy meal, a Roman banquet, and they would always have hors d'oeuvres, and so we're imitating that. That's possible. The reason the Gemara gives is v'hatmia et hatinokot. We do it to make the children ask questions. Which means, by the way, if we would ever answer the question, we'd be out of luck, because the child would ask, "Why did you do that?" And the answer is, "I did that so you'd ask the question." All right, good. But in the meantime, that's why we do it. Once we do it, aha, now we've got all sorts of beautiful symbolism. Why do we dip something that's green? Of course, in our family, we use potatoes. But in those families that use green, it symbolizes spring. And why salt water? Salt water symbolizes the tears. Well, you should know the Persian community doesn't use salt water. They use vinegar. It's perfectly fine. But we have different explanations that attach and are all beautiful and are real and are meaningful, but they're not the original reason. And the original reason, at least according to the Gemara, why we dip a vegetable at this point is lahatmia et hatinokot, to make the children ask questions and to provoke them. Which brings us to yachatz, and perhaps it is with yachatz that we will have to break for the evening, pun very much intended. After we wash our hands, and according to almost all minhagim, not the Gaon Mivilna, but according to almost all minhagim, we do not make a bracha on that hand washing. And then we have the vegetable. And of course, halachically, it's important to point out, you should have in mind when you make the bray prayer adamah, the vegetable, that it will also be, you're going to eat maror later. We then bring out, or we have three matzot at the table, and we make a big announcement about it, and take the middle matzah and break it in half, and take the bigger half and we hide it, and that's going to be the afikoman, and the smaller half is left on the table, and it's made into a very big ceremony. Why do we do this? Well, the fact that we need a broken matzah, that is something which can already find its roots in the Torah, and is a quite explicit in the Gemara. And that is that the Torah refers to matzah as lechem oni, the bread of affliction, the bread of a poor man. And that's one of the first things we say. We haven't gotten there yet, but halach ma'anya, we refer to the bread as the bread of affliction. And the Gemara says, ma darko shel ani biprusa. The Gemara in Brachot and in Psachim says, what does a poor man have? He has a part of a bread, a part of a loaf. And in the same way, a matzah, which is a loaf, it's baked as one, he doesn't have a full loaf. So therefore, to have proper lechemoni, we need to have a broken piece. So why do we have three matzot? The answer is quite straightforward. After all, the Seder is a festive meal. It is seudah chagigit. And just like at every festive meal of Shabbat and Yom Tov, we have to have lechem mishnah, we have to have two loaves to remind us of the miracle of the man in the desert. So therefore, we have to have two full matzot. We have to have a broken one. So what do we have? We have two and a half. Parenthetically, you should know that the Rambam and the Rif and many other Rishonim were of the opinion that really at the Seder you should have not two and a half, but one and a half. In other words, the Seder should not have two full loaves and then another broken one, but rather the poverty is indicated by having less than usual, and that is to have two, one of which is broken. I know you don't have a full one. And indeed, that is the Gaon Mivilna's custom, it's also our family custom, to have only two matzot at the table, unless some say that if it's Shabbat, lechem mishnah may be a din d'oraita, therefore we have two and a half. But in any case, you bring out either two and a half or one and a half to the table. But that's not what happens here. What happens here is we bring out either two or three full ones and break one and hide it and make a whole to-do about it. Why is that? The answer is, again, it's part of getting the children curious. It's getting the children's attention. And it works. Kids universally are very interested in seeing where the afikoman is and where Uncle Harry hid it and how he handed it over to Cousin Jared and where it's going to end up and how am I going to find it during the meal so that I can get the big prize at the end. So it does have that effect. And that is, so in other words, right after Kiddush, we engage in a series of activities, the goal of which is to provoke the children into asking questions by saying, why are we doing all this strange stuff? At that point, we get into formally telling the story in the section that we formally call Magid. The opening paragraph of Magid, which we'll touch on in two shiurim from now, we'll discuss somewhat in detail, Halach Ma'anya, just a couple words about it before the end of the shiur. Halach Ma'anya is the only paragraph in the entire text of the Haggadah, the way we read it, that's not in Hebrew. Now, that doesn't mean that the Haggadah has to be read in Hebrew. As a matter of fact, the Haggadah should not be read in Hebrew. The Haggadah should be read in the language that the people around the table understand. Now, that's a very, very important notion, is that the Haggadah is learning, it's teaching, it's discussing, it's understanding. There is absolutely no value to reading the Haggadah without understanding what the words mean. There are certain passages, perhaps, that have to be recited in the original. Perhaps Pesach Matzah Maror. Likely the Brachot, although not necessarily. That's a machloket, whether or not the Brachot could be said in other languages, between Rabbi Kiv Eger. But certainly everything else, all of the texts and all of the Midrashim, etc., should be said in the language people understand. Of course, people want to sing Dayenu, they don't want to sing in English. Of course, that's understandable. But the learning part must be done in a language people understand. Halach Ma'anya is the one paragraph that's not officially in the Haggadah in Hebrew. The question is, why is it in Aramaic? And leave you with a different question, which is, should it be said in Aramaic at a table of non-Aramaic speakers, which is most of us? Should it be said in Hebrew, if they're all Israelis? Should it be said in Hebrew, people who understand Hebrew? Should it be said in English? Should it be said in several languages so everyone understands? Of course, how are we going to answer the question? That all depends on why it is written in Aramaic. There are those who argue that it is written in Aramaic because Aramaic is a symbol of the language of exile, and it's a statement about exile. And and that's something we'll touch on in two shiurim. There are those who argue, and by far the preponderance of opinions on this, is that halach ma'anya is in Aramaic, because that was the spoken language, the lingua franca of the people at the time it was formulated, and therefore that it should be said in whatever language people understand. And indeed, there is opinion of several Rishonim that halach ma'anya, if you look at it very carefully, includes a mention of matzah, maror, and pesach, and therefore following Rabban Gamliel's dictate that everyone has to explain pesach, matzah, maror, it's a way of having, if you will, a mini haggadah right at the beginning for those people who are not going to make it through the rest of the evening. Children, for instance. So at least they hear halach ma'anya, that's matzah. This is that our ancestors ate in Egypt. That's Maror. And then we invite everyone in to join us for Korban Pesach. How can we invite anyone in to join us for Korban Pesach? That's something we'll discuss a week from now. In the meantime, Yirtzeh Hashem, we will end this year and pick up next Monday with a shiur on the Arba Banim and on the Mitzvah Haggadah in the Torah and how we arrive at the Arba Banim. And then next Thursday, we'll continue with our study of the Seder and the discussion about the paragraph Halach Ma'anya. Everyone should have a wonderful Shabbos, and we'll be in touch on Monday.